I went to the library and got the Decline of the Rest and read it. I thought, this is okay, this is crazy.
Yeah.
I was pretty well on the left. Boswell's Penguin is just the side of Ayn Rand.
Yeah,
yeah. You know?
Yeah.
So I thought, well, no, but nevertheless, but it is fascinating.
These like New York stories are like impossibly romantic, I find.
Black guy.
My first time was with a stable boy. Yeah, because I grew up in the countryside. The local stables.
So, and then, as I said, and
but we should
later,
probably.
Yeah.
Maybe we should pause and then.
I
don't know when they're going to queue us up.
It was 2 or 3 a day.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You said 50,000.
Yeah, 50,000. Where are you getting this number from?
pretty soon there were things, you know, I was going out to cruise every other day.
Okay.
And I would have 12 contacts a day.
Oh, so you were just at... Oh, we should save this for later. So I was, it's so funny. It's like, well, we could just have a conversation. and then they'll cue us up. I was asking Chip where this number of 50,000 partners comes from. Like,
I was telling her.
He calculated it based on, well, I go out every other day and 12 per day, so therefore 50,000.
Yeah, pretty soon it had gone up. I remember when it went over 3,000, and I thought, huh?
Were you tallying it up like every time you came?
I think I started out sort of trying to keep track of them, you know, and you keep track of them up to 25, 40, 50, and suddenly it's more than several hundreds, and you should realize. And then, so then you have to just generally estimate.
Did you have a party, like your 3,000 mark?
No. I was married during all this.
Divorce party?
No, my wife was, I, when I married my then wife, when we got married, one of the things that happened is I said, you know I'm gay. You know, and she said, of course I do. You've taken me cruising with you. and I said, well, I just wanted to make sure you knew. You really understood. And so that's
something that we actually haven't heard you talk about much, what it was like being married to a woman while you were out, you know.
And we had sex. We had sex. It was, but much more infrequently.
Yeah.
But much more infrequently.
Yeah, so it felt like no contradiction to you.
Well, I mean, it just was, you know, well, the thing is, it was what, my life was composed of two things. It was basically composed of writing. I mean, I wrote 5 novels in the first few years. You know, it was called writing and sex. And it was the sex alone that made it possible to do the writing. Because otherwise, and I had a nervous breakdown. And I don't know which one was more responsible. I don't, you know. I think it was overwork. You know, you write 5 novels while you're doing all this stuff. And, you know, in 3 years, 2 years, that's, and when you have to rewrite them as many times as I did because I was hopelessly dyslexic. It was, you know, that's the way it went.
Maybe we
the
should.
The novels are still in print. That's something to be proud of. I think.
Hell yeah! Congrats on that. We didn't even introduce ourselves because we immediately started talking about 50,000 partners.
This is Jackie Wang.
Yes.
Right? And this is Hugh
Lemmy.
Lemmy.
There's a Hugh Lumley who's somebody else entirely. And I keep on wanting to call you Hugh Lumley. This is Hugh Lemmy.
And you know.
And I'm Chip Delaney.
Chip Delaney, yes, welcome. So what I wanted to do tonight was to get a sense of both of your experiences and kind of hear about how you think they meet up, where they diverge, what is new about the society that we live in, and how has technology shaped our relationship to sex? Because I think about how basically all dimensions of social life is being transformed by technology. And so it's, you know, we've had a lot of conversations behind the scenes, but I was asking Chip about Grindr and how, you know, cruising without Grindr might compare to Grindr. And Chip was like, well, I don't know. I don't use Grindr, Hugh. What do you think about that? Yeah. So maybe that's a good place to start, because Chip, in Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, you talk about contact and inter-class relations being a component of making contact and the chance element.
Why don't we let Hugh talk first?
Yeah. Okay, sure. I mean, yeah. Because you were also talking about your experience also coming from a rural setting and how it's different as well.
Well, I think the thing that Grindr throws up, as with like a lot of these new technologies, is it's a the sort of fluctuating nature of what is public and private anyway, and especially with relations to like gay sex, especially with traditionally the notion of a private domestic sphere is actually really shut off to gay men under under vice laws, because if you can have your house raided at any time, is it really a private space anyway? So I think with the legalization of homosexuality, at least in the UK, then there was quite strict rules in those laws about what denoted a private space. So when they legalized sodomy in 67, it had to be within a private house, and that included the front door had to be locked. There couldn't be anyone else in that house, just you two as a couple. The curtains had to be drawn. I mean, it's really, really strict. So then what in that situation, then it removed that sort of legitimate gay sex into an extremely tight private sphere. And I guess what's interesting now with stuff like Grindr and these changing attitudes is it blurs what are those sexual spaces and what are those public and private spaces again. I think in terms of sexualization of spaces, I think there's something quite interesting between like the cruising grounds and like those territories that you get within cities that are established through I guess sort of an oral culture or a tradition, like someone tells you where it is or you pass that information on, and then this new thing of a sexualized space existing all over the place, you know, in the office when you sort of sneak on Grindr and when you're supposed to be at work, or, you know, all sorts of spaces, you know, the back of a bus that become like eroticized again as sort of virtual cruising grounds.
So you actually think that Grindr is bringing the sex back into space and, you know, resisting the ways in which the vice laws are attempting to push it back into private?
No, well, in some ways, but then, I mean, it's a curate's egg. It's a real mixed bag, because on the other hand, it becomes a very atomized experience, an isolated experience, and it becomes one that's totally mediated by the technology and the algorithms within the technology, and the sort of social forms that exist within Grindr anyway, the way you're supposed to present yourself. So it's it's complicating it, I'd say.
Yeah, and Chip, what I was wondering in relation to Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, when you talk about contact, chance meetings are a part of that. Meeting people you wouldn't otherwise meet in your everyday life. And you know, now that when we think about how technology mediates our relationships, who we come into contact with is often mediated by apps and social media. And so does that keep us in atomized bubbles, or does that enable contact?
Well, I don't. I think various and sundry institutions are what enable the contact. At Stonewall, I was, 27 years old? So I'd lived the first 27 years of my life prior to Stonewall, and I don't think, and before computers. I mean, Stonewall was computers were not a big part of what was going on. I didn't have I moved out to San Francisco for 2 years,
mm-hmm.
And I didn't take a computer with me. I didn't have a, you know, I didn't have a computer. And there was a typewriter already there, and so you know, I was very interested where one would find both movie theaters. And there were movie theaters on Market Street. Like the Empire Movie Theater was very much like the Variety Photo Place. In New York City, down on Third Avenue,
mm-hmm.
And these places, these are the places that I sought out, and I sought them out more than I sought out gay bars because they were far more efficient, you know, than gay bars. You know, they were not, you know, gay bars, which is what was talked about. You know, required an immense investment of time. You know, you had to sit at a bar and chat up somebody for a long time, and it did work or it didn't work. You know, and then you know, so that was not where the action was. You
mm-hmm.
know, the action was in the movie theaters that encouraged this kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
of which there was more than one on in the Market Street.
Did it take you a second to figure that out? Like, oh, the action's not in the gay bar.
And they said, oh, you want to go, you know, that's what you're interested in, go there.
Okay. And what was the difference in the clientele?
The clientele was much, again, like the movie houses, the clientele was the varied people that you would, the various people you would see come into a movie theater. You know, there were a lot of, that's where you would go, and you'd find Latino, and you'd find Black, and you'd find white, probably with a prevalence of white.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you mentioned behind the scenes, you were talking about posting a classified ad, where you were seeking out. Do you want to describe what you're seeking out? A nail biter? Or yeah, you were saying that they were like, oh, there's nobody for you.
Well,
like,
yeah. Well, the thing is, you have there are things that you like. There are kinds of physical things that you like about people, and mine were a little different from. So, you know, I do think that when computers sort of got going, I remember I thought, oh, okay, let's try the computer, you know. And so I dialed up a computer on my K-Pro. Does anybody remember
two
computers? You know, you know, along with Osgood, you know, they're primitive things that don't even look like they had green and gray screens, you know. That's all. They weren't even color. Not color monitors yet. But I put in my desire. I was looking for people who were older than I was. I was looking for people who were heavier than I was. I was looking for. I said, and by the way, I have a preference for guys who bite their nails, which I do, you know. And they said, gosh, we don't have that. You know, everybody else is looking for people who are younger than they are, you know, and skinny. You know, and we can't deal with you, you know. So I said, okay, then obviously the thing to do is to go back out on the street where I can find what I'm looking for, you know. So I went back to the movie theaters where there were all sorts of people, and I could find what I was looking for, and I found a fair number of them.
So you found a lot of older nail biters who.
Yes, I certainly did. Yes, I'm now living with one for 27 years.
Yeah.
Well, he's not older. He's a younger nail biter. But when I first met him, I thought he was older because he was homeless and he was and the 6 years on the street had aged him surprisingly. Mm-hmm. And it was not until after we had been together that this guy whom I really thought was my age or older turned out to be 12 years younger than I was, and I was quite surprised. But he was very nice. And I'm still with, we're still together, and I, you know, and thus it goes.
So, Hugh, maybe this is a good moment to bring you in, because this anecdote about, you know, submitting this classified and being told, well, there's, you know, there's no one for you out there. And now thinking about technology and the proliferation of fetishes, positions, sexualities, gender identities. Do you think that technology provides more outlets for the variety of sexual preferences that exist?
Yeah, of course, and it's the sort of infrastructure of the technology or the design of it actually helps proliferate that as well, I think. I think it allows you to find new fetishes that you would never have even considered as possible, or to share those fetishes with other people and therefore like develop them in that way. But I do think there's an issue there about like almost, I don't want to say too much choice, but maybe a narrowing down. And like you're saying, you can have a checklist of quite specific things, and actually, because there's a smorgasbord of on offer, that there's a sort of a pickiness that can be developed from that, which is quite different, I think, to cruising in real life, you know, in physical space, because there's a more embodied desire and there's chance that plays a role. Mm-hmm. So I think that's probably like one of the main things that structures it differently.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's also a thing that we were talking about earlier as well, which is to do with the investment of, or the dual nature of a lot of things like Grindr and apps like that, which is they also offer a sort of instant real-life pornography for people.
Mm-hmm.
So although they're designed for people to meet and chat and stuff, actually it also provides a sort of masturbatory function.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that can be a real frustration within the design of the app, because it hasn't really figured a way to split those two camps. Whereas if you're in a park or down by the docks, for example, you've made an investment to go out. You're not there just to look necessarily. I mean, some people will be as a part of what they're into.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think that's maybe one of those splits.
Yeah, my partner has a theory about not Moore's law, but porn's law, which is like when you started, you know, being able to get porn on your phone, the phones stop getting smaller, they start getting bigger.
Yeah.
But Chip, have you ever used, you know, your phone or any apps or cruising things?
On a regular size computer all the time.
On a regular size one. And how does it feel when you think about, you know, the experiences you wrote about in Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, and thinking about finding people on the internet?
Well, one of the things that's happened is in the last few years, the number of people that number of contacts has gone way the fuck down.
Hmm.
You know, and you know, and I kind of miss it.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of miss it. I seem to be okay, more or less okay with it. I doesn't, you know, if it presents itself to me, and from time to time it does. The last piece I published, it was an article about sex among older gay men, for which I went up to New York to go to my first sex party. Which was interesting, and I wrote an article about it, and I wrote an article about going to visit an old fuck buddy in Dover Plain. My lover and I, or my significant other, or whatever you call him, or my partner, my life partner, we have a we have an open relationship, which requires a certain amount of care, but we're both used to it at this particular point. And we work at, you know, that's you can read the article. It's online in the Boston Review. It was called Ash Wednesday, because the thing started. I got the idea for the article last Ash Wednesday, I don't know. You know, you live your. There, so far, I haven't ever come across an article on how to be Chip Delaney. You know, Chip Delaney leads an unusual life. I do understand that, but it's mine, so it doesn't seem that unusual to me, because it's the one I lead every day.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's the way.
In that article you're talking, it's arranged by another guy, isn't it? Like how he regularly arranges those sex parties for older men.
Somebody else whom I had met at a comic at a convention on gay comics in New York just before I retired and moved down to Philadelphia, who started necking with me in the middle of the, you know, and it turns out that he is he gets the hots for older gaddy bears with beards.
But does he organize organize that online as well? How does he make those contacts? So they. Long existing friendships, or does he invite people online, or post on Craigslist? Or
I don't know how he gets the people. Although, however, somebody else has made a kind of the a guy named Charles Lum has made a film called Secret Santa Sex Party, which I would invite you all to see. It's a very good little film. It's only about 10 or 15 minutes long. And then he has made a much longer film called Sex and the Silver Gaze, which contains all the specific sex in Secret Santa Sex Party, but it also contains interviews with all the guys, the same guys that I went up to see and have a and go to one of their sex parties with. And then when the film was aired, when the Secret Santa Sex Party was aired in Philadelphia, he came down, and because I had written an article about the same group, he took me to see his film. Which was very nice, and I enjoyed it. And it was very interesting to sit in a movie theater and see on the screen all these guys with whom I'd had sex about 3 weeks before. You know, on the and I thought, well, that's interesting. Now, is that public sex or not? That's not the kind of sex that I write about in Times Square Red and Times Square Blue, but that's what presented itself. Mm-hmm. You know. And that varies city to city. Because I live in Philadelphia, that's not as available to me as it would have been if I'd been in New York, if I'd stayed in New York.
Okay, so this actually, you said some things that maybe could bring us to the next question about having less sex now, and kind of wondering, is it related to seeking it out on the internet or where you live in Philadelphia? Maybe you could talk a little bit about the things that affect the rhythm of our sexual desire. So it could be aging, it could be illness, it could be taking medications, all of these things.
May I propose something? I would much rather hear about what affects the rhythm of your sexual desire. You're on this panel too. Come on.
Okay. I was told that I'm like moderating, but okay.
Well, I think but this is we're all supposed to be having a conversation, It should be sort of equal.
I mean, yeah, mental health.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, sometimes there's an eros to conflict could actually turn me on sometimes.
Do you pursue public sex?
I've had a little bit. Gosh, I'm in the hot seat now.
And the other thing is, I think that one of the things that I have certainly been aware of since almost the very beginning is that the way this affects women and the way this affects men is very, very different.
Yeah, I think out of my friends, I'm like the awkward non-sexual being or something. I'm just thinking about, I used to yearly go to Ida Palooza, which is like it's a queer festival that happens in the woods in Tennessee. Everyone hooking up everywhere all the time. There's a few people who don't, but I was just like, really nervous. A little bit.
May I ask a couple of specific questions? Because I know this is something I know nothing about.
Okay.
You know, Hugh and I are talking about essentially gay stuff.
Yeah.
Is this basically heterosexual?
No, this is a queer commune.
This is a queer commune? Yeah. Is it queer female, queer men?
All genders.
All genders, but it's all queer.
Yeah, they don't like straight people at the queer commune.
Some of my best blowjobs have been straight guys. You know.
Well, sure, yeah, that's true. I mean, there is like a generational, tension too, like in terms of how definitions are even used, how people identify.
What do you do?
What do I do
in such a thing? I want to know what's done. I don't talk about it.
Okay.
Describe it.
Well, from my anthropological perspective, because I was like, wait a minute, why do I have less casual sex than everyone else? And so I decided to observe what would happen on the commune, and it always involved alcohol. So I would observe, you know, how orgies would get started. So there would be a bunch of really drunk people who would maybe start dancing, and then they would like, okay, let's go in the barn now with all the people. Or, and then there are some people that my friend Clutch says, yeah, sex is just like exercise for me, and just has gay orgies in there.
Right. But then in the UK, there's a really big culture of straight public sex, which is dogging.
Okay. I don't know whether I've ever done it or not, because I don't know what the term refers
to.
It's called dogging because I think like traditionally like the sort of excuse you made was you're taking a dog for a walk.
Oh, I see.
And guys and women.
I call that cruising.
Yeah, they drive their car to a sort of a car park in the forest or in a nature reserve or something, and women and men, and they have sex in the car. Guys look in, guys get in the car, women get out. I don't know. You're asking the wrong person for the details. It's definitely. One thing that's interesting there, when compared to what you're saying about there being less. Contact, you having less contacts now, which is that it's gone. There's two aspects to it, which is one, which is necessity. Like you go cruising because you can't have sex in your own house, or you know your landlord or your landlady might live with you or whatever, so you have to go and have sex in the woods and things.
Yeah, uh-huh.
And then another one where it is like the anonymity and the fresh air and the smell of. Molding leaves and stuff is actually part of what gets you off.
Sure.
So,
yeah, yeah.
And with dogging, it's a paraphilia in itself, or a sort of sexual fetish in itself. Yeah. Like people like really, that it's not. Those people have presumably lots of them anyway. Will have houses and they could invite people back if they wanted to.
Yeah.
They choose the risk, I suppose, and the.
In Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, I argue that places for that to happen make for a more interesting city.
Yeah.
You know, and it attracts people from outside the city to come too, because they know, hey, you know, you can get laid here, you know, and you don't have to go to somebody's house, you know, which I think is it's taking the Jane Jacobs model one step further to include the sexual. You know, you giggle as though you're embarrassed. I don't think it's an embarrassing thing. I think it's something that makes for a more interesting urban landscape. Nor do I know how it pertains or appertains. I have not the vaguest idea, nor have I discovered how it appertains to Glasgow. You know, does it?
It used to be a port town, so
yeah. I mean, yeah.
There's probably docks and
probably
sailors.
At some point it did.
Yeah.
Yeah. Does the technology inhibit it here, or does? Or, you know.
Well, this is a question, like. Is the technology, crushing these spaces? I mean, in Times Square Red, Times Square Blue, you talk about urban renewal and also, you know, police focusing on criminalizing vice and policing vice. Maybe you want to talk a little bit about why the public sex gets pushed out of spaces.
Usually it comes in because it's making someone money, and gets pushed out because they will make more money when they push it out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you think the moral stuff is just the justification for it?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is just this is just one aspect of multiple different things that have been totally affected by a changing attitude towards public and private space, and the privatization of public space, and with it, the privatization of a public sphere, what can happen there. So, for example, in London, the City Hall is located in a sort of like new estate that's built, and you can walk, I used to walk through it every day to get to work, and there's a park, et cetera, et cetera. It's privately owned, the security guards, and you can't protest there without a license outside the City Hall. So that's just like another aspect.
Right.
The sort of changing attitudes that came around in the sort of 90s, at least in the UK, of a neoliberal attitude towards public space, and a neoliberal attitude towards what might be termed as antisocial behavior, I think, is a part of this real crackdown. You know, in the 20s and 30s, you had this huge crackdown in London in the UK using the sort of language of morality and the vice squads.
Mm-hmm.
And then under sort of New Labour, that came back, but under the guise of antisocial behavior, which was a much wider term and could be applied with like much less strict sort of legal argument, you know, they just slapped one on you and order on you. You couldn't argue with that.
In the U.S., the post-war sex panic, queers were called communists. That was one way.
The lavender scare.
Yeah. Gays are reds. I'm like, okay, I'll take it.
Which is ironic, though, because actually most of the leading figures in the FBI and the people who were in
I know, right.
Joe McCarthy, Hoover, probably gay. Hoover,
also
probably gay.
Also gay, too. Yeah, I know.
And people like Cohen, definitely.
Oh, definitely, yeah. With in the post-war thing as well, I think in the UK, like that's another aspect of it, which is a sort of more of an increase in housing stock as well, and things like that led to less need for public sex as well. And there's a great book by Matt Holbrook called Queer London, which is a history of anti-gay repression and public space in London in the sort of 20s and 30s. But in that, he says that prior to the Second World War, if you walked through Victoria Park, which is the huge park in East London, in sort of late evening, it'd be full of people having sex, mm-hmm. mostly heterosexual or all heterosexual, because the area was full of tenements. People lived with their parents until they were, you know, quite old, until they were married. So if you wanted to have sex, the only place you could have it was outside.
Right. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, I lived in London for 2 years. My daughter was born there, and there were what was the place? It was Golders Green in the early 70s, in 73, 74. You know, it was, you know, you after, you know, after time, that place was just covered with male bodies. You know, covered, and, you know, many of them having sex with one another, you know, and some people would actually bother to go and hook up in the loo and then come out to have sex on the grass, you know, but many of them wouldn't even get that far, you know, and so it was all very, it was fascinating.
And you're saying, you were talking about this earlier, and you're saying they were migrant laborers,
yes.
Generally.
Yeah, and there was a class element of it. This was back when as I described it a couple of times, when drunken Irish laborer was one word, and it was not a very pretty word, but I do remember looking out of a Camden Town flat at a vacant lot, I guess it was a Saturday morning, and seeing it covered again in the same way as Golders Green was with male bodies, you know, who were all had fallen out together. And I realized something as a black man from the United States. I had seen large groups of black people in this state. I had never seen that many white people in that state. It was a new experience for me, you know, which was very good. Mm-hmm. I knew, you know, anybody could get there, but it was nice to know that, you know, that worked. And as I said, it was also related, at least I learned in terms of what was going on a mile or so up the road at Golders Green, that there were places where it became overtly sexual, you know.
So this might be a good point to open it up to the audience for questions. I don't know if there's a microphone around, and everyone gets illuminated now also. So there were more, okay, so let's.
Hi. Lovely to hear you all. I have a multi-part question, I guess. I wanted to ask you, particularly Hugh, because, Sean Fay told me about you, the incredible journalist, who on Twitter, she will put up her conversations with men, and it's quite revealing that for straight men, they don't often know how to talk about the sex that they want. Mm-hmm. And also there are threads on Reddit with gay men who are annoyed about the presence of trans women and straight men who seek them on Grindr. And I think it just brings up for me the designation of gendered sexual space and how that is going, because Oh, and I think it's really important to put, talk about where these places are so that people can find them. Like, you know, that, yeah, like I know Epping Forest is, yeah, a really good big dogging area. And I know also that fabswingers.com is a great place where you can actually like review each other. So yeah, it's funny because trans women, like the funny thing is that everyone says the same thing. Like on the, when women are reviewing men, it's always, great cock, you don't want to miss out on this one, girls. but I was just thinking, like, moving into the future, both for, like, public sexual space and online, is there going to still be a need for us to separate ourselves according to gender and sexuality? And if not, is that going to see, is that a liberalization and us sharing sexual space, is that something that is going to be positive for us all? Or are we going to lose something in there not being separate designated gay male sexual space and straight sexual space and transsexual space, etc.?
Yes, yeah, it's funny you mention Sean, actually.
She's like, hilarious.
Yeah, it's really interesting because yeah, Sean's great. It's a really explicitly gay male space grinder, like it's designed for gay men, mm-hmm. But it is always, it's always had, within, for those who don't know how it works, there's a sort of profile page you can have and you can, you know, add in a bit of information about yourself and then your stats, your height, et cetera, et cetera. And then also a very strange one, which I think they call it tribes now, mm-hmm. which you select, like, you know, I can't even remember, like, I think there's like jock, twink, bear, rugged, otter, for example, pos, and trans. But it never actually says whether tribes is who you are or what you're looking for, which I think is quite an interesting sort of dynamic. But yeah, there's always been obviously trans women on there, but it wasn't until really having a lot of discussions with Sean. And I'll let you into a little secret, because we've got a WhatsApp group with me and her and another friend called Bad Grinder, where we just share all this sort of stuff that you probably shouldn't make public, but between the three of us. And the posting rate of terrible messages is probably 1 to 50 for me and this other guy with Sean, who's just... And yeah, she showed me... She goes online in London and has, like, 200, 300 messages within an hour and a half and something. Mm-hmm. So it's clearly a space that's being used by a lot of straight men who are looking for trans women, mm-hmm. Which Sean talks about a lot, and that there's no other infrastructure for that which exists in such a way, I guess. But I don't know in terms of the divisions. Like, I think there will always be a narrowing down, actually. I think as with the apps, you know, it used to be one or two, but now, like, the specificity of them, and so as well as having the tribes, you can also download Scruff if you're into that sort of, you know, bigger, hairier guys, or if you're into much bigger, hairier guys, Growler, or these sort of things. So actually, I think the marketplace is always going to produce more and more options, mm-hmm. in that way, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a quote that I just lifted from Kinsey. You know, that in terms of what I wish I could remember it exactly, but it basically, I mean, in terms of what goes sexually, there, pretty much everything has happened at one time or another that you can imagine, and a lot more that you can't. You know, and that is the situation. And people always have different parameters that they're looking for. And you can't, it's very, very hard to operationalize them all in one set of operations that will cover everybody, you know. As I said, I have my own things, the own thing. And I'm sure when I published an autobiography back in 1988, and after I would publish, and I went on a book tour, you know, and I would talk about it, and people would come up to me afterwards, and I noticed that the major people who came up to me were basically more or less straight men. What does that mean? It means that they were men who, one guy who said, hey, look, I am really queer for, he didn't use the word. He said, what really turns me on is kind of heavy women with glasses, you know, and I noticed, but And at a certain point, I noticed, why was it always the straight men who were coming up to tell me about what it was they wanted? Because they still have all the fucking power. You know, they are used to getting what they want and asking for what they want. And that we still often just aren't used to articulating what it is we want. Sometimes we have to learn to articulate what it is we want, because that itself is seizing power.
Oh, and also to listen. And to listen to others, because that's the other thing that, like, Sean has really shown me, which is, yes, there might be 300-400 guys who want to get in touch with her and hook up with her, but 299 of them don't know how to talk to somebody and explain their desire in a polite way, in a way that isn't dehumanizing.
Yes. Absolutely.
Thank you.
There's a hand back here.
I hate talking into microphones. Do you feel like urban spaces are like defining sexuality? Because the whole conversation so far has been kind of about living within one, like New York and even Glasgow is like quite a big urban area. I don't know how you imagine sexuality if you live in like a kind of less populated space.
Well, we talked about this a bit earlier. I grew up in Cumbria, like in a really rural spot, and pre-grinder. I think even pre-gaydar, I think, I don't know, I didn't have a computer, in fact, like a personal computer. And I knew 5 gay men my age, and I spent most weekends with them, and I'd had sex with all of them. And, it, you know, this was age like 15, 16.
In approximately what year, ballpark?
2001, 2002 okay. maybe. And... And then now when I go back to my dad's house and go online, it's obviously a lifesaver, or it's creating huge numbers of connections for people. And it's really underage. I think, I don't, you know, there's a lot of sort of 14, 15-year-olds who are using it. Mm-hmm. I think actually it has a different function. But also within when you look at people's profiles in rural areas, or this has been my experience, it recreates some scene dynamics. There's clearly people referencing each other, or you talk to somebody and they're like, "Have you seen this guy 3 squares along on the Grindr grid or whatever?" You know, like, you know, they're sharing that information, which I think is a real issue with Grindr, which is I used to use other sort of websites where there were. As well as the profile pages, there were forums, so that there's some infrastructural space for discourse there, where ideas can be shared and political ideas, and people could call each other out on stuff that was kind of a bit fucked up that people were saying, or develop discussions. Whereas it's really just mainly a broadcast space on Grindr, and so there's not actually there's quite strange dynamics of people trying to have a public conversation saying, like, don't be sexually racist, I'm not interested in you if you're using these terms, et cetera, et cetera. But there's no real space for a multi-person discussion on it, which, and in a rural space, that's how that plays out, which is, it's people, I find that there's a struggle to find a community through that technology, because it's kind of the only technology that's mass used in those spaces, I think. In my experience.
So the queer commune that I've spent a lot of time on, Ida, is in the woods, and it's they call this area the Gayberhood. It's in Tennessee.
They have one in Philadelphia too.
Yeah,
I lived in
lots
it for
of
several
fairies,
years. Yes.
Communities, yeah. Yeah. And so yeah, there was the fairy community Short Mountain that started and then Ida started after Short Mountain. There was a lot of people who were involved with ACT UP who started these intentional communities, and they're really into the, you know, rural homesteading lifestyle. Like, my friend Clutch built their house. And, you know, we're into developing relationships with the neighbors too in this, you know, rural Tennessee. So they strongly identified as, you know, being, you know, queers living in the South in a rural setting. Mm-hmm.
Hello. You were talking earlier on about the proliferation of desires. One thing that's always struck me about Grindr specifically is how kind of narrow and spectacular some desires are. So the kind of, I had always imagined, or the internet is this space within which there's a proliferation of desires, but then you come to apps like Grindr, and there's actually a real like narrowing of desire where often it's quite racialized, that whiteness is desired, that skinniness and muscularity and masculinity are kind of almost totalizing. And I've seen that kind of shift in recent years, but I was kind of like amazed by this technology that could be really expansive and could be really diverse, but somehow has this level of publicity where more niche desires don't get representation. And I don't know if you had any views or opinions on that.
Nail biters in the house.
I can't answer that because, as I said, for one thing, I've never used Grindr, I don't know whether I don't walk around thinking, gosh, why don't I use Grindr? I mean, I don't particularly miss
it.
It was more
of a Hugh question.
Huh?
It was more directed at Hugh maybe.
Yeah, right, yeah.
it reflects wider social trends, right? Like those dynamics existed and exist outside of Grindr. It magnifies those in some ways. The lack of, like I'm saying, a forum way to discuss things means that people can kind of get away with, without those sort of social links between different people, maybe on a friendship level, and the fact that those things can be discussed, people can get away with saying horrendous stuff because if someone pulls them up on it, they just block it. You know, they don't care. Mm-hmm. And also, I think the technology structures some of those desires as well. So the sort of focus constantly on the image, obviously. And then also the technology in terms of the algorithms on a lot of them, not on Grindr. I think a good thing about that is it doesn't really have much algorithmic design, but still within, you know, I was thinking, in fact, in terms of the rural thing, this drop-down menu of, you know, you can choose, you know, twink or bear or whatever, it really encourages, I think, people to think of themselves within those strange sort of social cultural categories. But when I was growing up, I had no idea what a twink was until I left that rural space. And I wonder now that if I was 14 and living in a countryside and I was offered those options, I'd think, okay, I've got to choose one of these. Which of these am I?
Yeah, there's a side of me that as soon as I hear something like, okay, I mean, I'm an African American, you know, of 75 years old, and I hear something like, if you use these kind of terms, I'm not interested in, you know, in don't bother me. I am looking for people who are comfortable using these terms. You know, that sounds to me like sex. You know, rather than that, and sex and a relationship between sex and language, rather than I am only interested in people who don't use the terms. And so, how do you deal with that side of the thing? And it's not necessarily a masochistic thing. It's just and uses, and that I'm interested in people who use them, but don't use them with a deprecating intentions or whatever, you know.
But I mean, maybe this is one of the differences again between the sort of world that you describe in, and a sort of formulation of desire you describe in Times Square, which is that what was the word that you used earlier? Aleatory.
Oh, aleatory.
Yeah, like chance or serendipity. Mm-hmm. Like sometimes in terms of desire, you don't know what you like until you've tried it.
Right, exactly.
And if you set out with those terms or with those strict parameters and you're only going to accept people, you know, who live up to that. Whereas when you're cruising, like, you know, you might end up with somebody who doesn't necessarily entirely match those things and it turns out, oh yeah, that's what I'm into.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sorry, I'm trying to decide which of the like million things that I want to ask and say. It's really hard. I think one of the things more, I guess, to add to the conversation is what I think can be really difficult with, and this is maybe where language works differently through technology, is so for example, I hook up with someone, get their phone number, say, oh, I'm just at the same party as them, so we hook up. The next day, Facebook is like, do you want to be friends with this person?
Yeah.
No, fuck off. I don't want to be friends with them. I don't want to know anything about them. But there's a kind of, and it's complicated because a lot of about public sex is saying like, we are rejecting the definitions between private and public space and how those oppress us. But at the same time, like, no, Facebook, I don't want to know where that person went to school. I actually like don't want, and I think because you, those spheres become so squished together, if there's someone who is, for example, using certain terms when you're fucking, and then they come up on your Facebook feed the next day when you're trying to, like, I don't know, do whatever you're doing, it somehow just feels more that it, like, yeah, it's more part of your life, and it kind of, I think maybe that's where these things become more complicated and more, like, insidious as well.
So you think technology is forcing us to drag our sexual baggage around with us all the time? Like, because this is also, you're like, you might not even see the, in the scenarios that you describe, you might not even see the face of the person, but now it's like, hey, you guys should be connected forever and interact with each other's profiles.
I never contact people on phone, but I always do WhatsApp. And
yeah.
I always save their name as whatever name they've told me, and then G for Grindr. Like, if I've met with them, so I know who they are, I can remember, whatever. And there's an interesting moment where you actually get on with the person, you like them, you meet them again. When do you delete the G? And when do they just become a person their own right? They're like no longer a Grindr hookup, they're actually now our friends.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Hi. I was wondering, because when we are speaking about technology and how technology shapes sexuality, which is super, super interesting, I think another part of technology is drugs and drug use, and like how drug use shapes sexuality, how, yeah. And I was wondering if you maybe want to talk a little bit about that, like how, from your experience, how drug use shapes sexuality.
I know when I'm looking for drugs, I go to the queers.
Sure. Yeah.
Sorry. Oh, no, this is being recorded.
Sounds reasonable.
Yeah. Well, you know, when it depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking, you know, there's looking for an encounter now, you know, like now, you know, and then as soon as it becomes, well, do I do this again? Then it suddenly becomes, what do the people who we pass on the street think of me when they see me with him, her, it, them, whatever, you know? And then, you know, what will my family think? You know, I mean, there's a whole, in you know, expanding range of things. And, you know, am I the sort of person who doesn't give a fuck what my family thinks, but I do care what my friends think, don't care what my friends think, but do care what my family, you know? And there are all of these that run in, that become part of the expansive situation, you know, and we've all seen bits and pieces of this on a lot of date. I assume there is daytime what we call daytime television in the States, and there's been a lot of that. I assume it's not entirely unknown here. Yeah.
Do you have
okay, just quickly on the drugs thing. Like, my new novel is based on, which is, although the press will tell you in a sort of extreme tabloid sort of terror scare that this is the new craze is chemsex, and that's and like there's definitely been an uptake in like chemsex groups and parties and stuff happening. Well, I mean, where I live in London, it's like you go online. Personally, for me, it sounds like a complete nightmare. Like, they call it high and horny. I can do high and I can do horny, but the two of them together,
It's really hard to have sex on drugs.
Like, so much neuroses involved. But that's why, I think that's why people, that's part of it, is actually because obviously it gets rid of the neuroses for a lot of people, or the anxieties around it. It frees up the inhibitions and stuff. I think what would be more interesting, sort of going forwards, and this is a plot theme in my new novel, is actually what we need to develop is, like, politically is a sort of a new summer of love in the UK. You know, we had the summer of love in the 60s, and we had another one in the 90s. The one in the 90s really shut down the sort of football hooligan movement and a resurgent far right in the early 90s with ecstasy. I think we need a sex-based third summer of love that's based around hallucinogens.
Yes.
Hallucinogens.
Yeah. I'm all for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
I would
be there. Thought was, I thought we had one, though. I thought we had one already, but, you know. No, I think it probably wouldn't do any major harm to have another one.
Yeah.
How much do you guys think that the sort of societal taboo of talking about sex, and also public sex, of having sex in public, and having sex in public in front of people you might know, how much do you feel that kind of dampens an individual's sexuality, and how much does it fuel it, that taboo?
How much does it dampen, and how much does it, what was the other word?
Fuel.
Fuel.
That kind of like, it's naughty kind of feeling.
Well, I don't know. I think, I don't know. It's my answer to your question. I really don't know. I mean, I think how you are feeling personally is what fuels or dampens it. I'm feeling like having sex right now, or I'm not. And that may start from any number of things, like a breeze hits you, in a way that you think, oh, that feels good, and how that works. So, or the dog jumps on you, and starts licking you there, and all of these things are the things that go into what fuels, life is what fuels your sexuality, including what's going on inside your body, some of which you have control over and some of which you don't, So that's kind of the way that I think that works, Yeah.
Well, in your interview with Bell Hooks, you mentioned that sexual transgressiveness is about seeing the boundary and then crossing it.
Right.
But when you narrate your experiences, it's so like matter of fact, like not with this like, bad boy attitude of crossing the boundary. I don't know.
Yeah. I think. For me personally, despite having these opinions, writing these things, my own experience, I'm extremely anxious and neurotic person a lot of the time, and it scares me, and that's part of the thrill when I do it. But I'm not actually massively adventurous in those sort of terms, because in that situation, the thrill of it is and the risk is probably, and the anxiety that comes of it is sexualized for me. Sexualizing anxiety is a really nice way to deal with it. But actually, in terms of public sex or having sex outside, for me personally, the thrill, I know it sounds going to sound like a really sort of, Thoreau hippy dippy thing, but I like being outside. I like the smells, the sensations of nature. It's much nicer than a stuffy room, and so I'll tend to go to somewhere extremely private, and often with someone I already know or people I already know. Yeah. But the public aspect of it is more to do with being outside than necessarily being in a public space.
Yeah, you that line that you were talking about, Jackie, you see that line, and what happens with me is usually in the past I have just wandered. I thought, what's on the other side of it? And rarely do I find I'm the only person who's crossed it. I find that there's a whole lot of people who have already crossed it and are doing something interesting that the people on the other side don't know anything about. And that's what's mostly most interests me. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you for. Oh, there's one.
Sure.
I'm a younger person, and I've grown up mostly in the world of Grindr, but I think my understanding of a cruising culture, especially in the United States, had much to do with transit hubs and transit places and rest stops, and train station bathrooms, and then thinking about how one of my favorite things to do with Grindr or Scruff is to use it while traveling, so while on a train or on a bus, and you encounter these little spots and you leave these traces behind and you start talking to someone who's 250 feet away because their house is along the rail line and then suddenly they're 20 miles away.
Oh, you got to be careful because you might get someone who's on the same train and then you're trapped on a train with them. And then
well, that's the thrill. Yeah. And so I guess I kind of seeing that, I think that you two are bridging those two kind of moments of like the possibility of being on a phone speeding through the countryside versus like fucking someone in a train station bathroom. And I just, that's my question.
What was the question?
Just like thinking between those two things and like, you know, like I think that we desire to understand technology as being like this break from the past. But okay. I think that technology, kind of thinking about the scholar Wendy Chun, like desires us to imagine it as obsolescencing the past, but in fact they're like intimately entangled. So I guess transit and movement is really my question. Sorry, I was trying to cut it coyly short.
I don't know, I'll have to think about it. On the obsolescence thing though, we were talking about this earlier as well. I watched Queer as Folk, the UK Queer as Folk the other day, which is now, I think it's like almost 20 years old. And the first episode like actually has a plot line to do with, it presents like a dating technology as a new technology and he's on a profile. And there's actually a plot line based around the fact he's on a dial-up modem and the image is sort of loading. Dick, 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 like this, which is again like it's eroticized. It's like a striptease reveal, and oh it gets the end. And I can't remember exactly, but I think it turns out he does have a massive dick. It's fine, massive dick.
Oh. Yeah. Well, thank you. I guess. Yeah.
Thanks, Jackie.
Thank you.
That was really interesting.
That was fun.
Yeah, that's interesting, yeah. Uh-huh. Do I turn this off?
Just chuck this one here.
And it's got a power button on the other side. Push and hold it.
Hold it on to